You're listening to 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis, and this is Create Here. Produced by artists and curators from Big Car Collaborative, Create Here is your place to listen to conversations with people making intriguing, innovative, and impactful things happen on the cultural front in Indianapolis, Indiana, and beyond. Find out more and access additional episodes at WQRT.org.
This is Jim Walker, and you're tuned to Create Here, and I'm here with Stuart Hyatt. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me.
So, I hesitate to try to describe you as an artist because you do so many different things and take so many different approaches. So, would you do that for me?
My training is in sculpture and architecture, but I seem to spend all of my time listening and recording and making music out of the sounds around me. And so I approach music from the perspective of an architect and a designer, really shaping and designing sound more than sitting and writing notes about it. So I would call myself a designer of music.
Nice. And you're a National Geographic Fellow, and a lot of your work, especially lately, has been built around science and nature.
It has. Yeah, it's really the point of inspiration for me. I am a reluctant scientist. I kind of missed the boat maybe as a kid. Didn't have good science classes, but have always looked at it from the outside as a way of understanding the world. And the more deeply I understand the way scientists approach the world, I see a real similarity to my own spiritual, kind of metaphysical way of looking at the world. And then ultimately using data and collaborating with scientists to have that euphoric epiphany, those emotional moments, that may seem counterintuitive to data. But for me is like the way of touching the infinite universe.
It feels like in your new project, which is called Stations, you are able, previous projects, like the last one where you worked with bats, and then you've done other things with nature. This is where you were able, because of these listening and measuring stations, you were able to kind of tune into the science more directly and work with the scientists a little more directly?
Yeah, well, I'll back up a little bit to how the project started. I was approached by the Anchorage Museum, which is obviously in Alaska. It's just a super cool institution. I had never been there, and they invited me to come perform in their planetarium, which is like a cool proposal to get. But I wasn't really interested in sharing or promoting old work. I said, well, what if we did something new together?
Yeah.
And that conversation led to the commission of this whole new project. And Alaska is so big. And I write about in the book, like, I think over the last decade, the question that I've been trying to answer is this simple question of what does the earth sound like? And I've tried to answer that many ways. Like, what do people sound like? What do things sound like? What does the sky sound like? What do animals sound like? But below all of that, is there a fundamental earth sound? And yeah. So that was the question that I started asking as the project started.
It feels like now is an especially important time to consider the earth as a thing that makes sound and that does, it's not trying to make the earth more like a human, but it's actually trying to appreciate that it's alive.
Yeah, very much so. And so, not to anthropomorphize the earth,
right?
But the idea was that could the earth have a singing voice?
Yeah.
And then perhaps could a human sing along with that voice?
Right.
And so that's where Hannah Benn came in for these first 9 tracks as the perfect counterpoint to the earth voice. So the idea was to sing a duet, almost this hymnal. The working title for this for a while was Remote Hymns, Tundra Hymnal, like the idea of a hymnal being this series of songs that explores the human relationship with the divine, but replacing God with the rocky, salty, earthy mess that we stand on.
Right. And when you listen to the songs, it's with the previous project, when you were working with bats, you could hear the bat sounds because they're so distinct and unique. Mm-hmm. In this case, the sounds of the earth are less like recognizable maybe for people, but they're in there. And how do people find that or hear like if they want to sort of in their head isolate to hear these sounds in the mix with everything else, how do you find that, or is that something that you would want people to try to do?
I could point out to people the exact sounds that I recorded and how I made them audible and how I looped them. And I mean, I was not accurate with this stuff. I mean, I put reverb on them. I made beats out of them. I reversed them. I took great liberty to try to make these earth movements musical.
Yeah.
But I want listeners to hear the full orchestra and an experienced symphony attendee can say, oh, that's the oboe, that's the bass clarinet, but ultimately what you want is how those things fit together.
Right.
So the idea was to make this very full sound, but to not overdo it. But yeah, I mean, if I played for you some seismic, okay, here's a thought exercise.
Okay.
I will give you some seismic sounds for track number one, which is Station One. And then we can hear how those fit into the music. So what we'll hear first are these actual recordings from Station Number One. And then what you'll hear after that is how they're integrated into the first track on the album. So that's Station One, and here are the instrumentalists and the vocalists. So Masayoshi Fujita, who is just, in my opinion, the world's most interesting vibraphone player, he laid down some bowed vibraphone parts, which are those really nice harmonic drones you're listening to. And then Kasim Naqvi, who is the drummer for this awesome band called Dawn of MIDI, but does his own modular synthesis, he added the synths. Janie Cowan is an upright bass player. She added the bass, and all the while they're sending me these, and I'm cutting them apart and stitching them back together. And then Brad Weber, who records as Pick a Piper, but he's also the touring drummer for Caribou, which is how I found him.
Yeah,
he's this awesome Canadian percussionist. he added some beats, or tons of layers of beats. And then finally, Hannah added the vocals and these really layered textural. And notice she's not saying words.
Right.
She's humming in a non-language and oohing and aahing in a language that is supposed to have a duet with those earth sounds. So that's what you're hearing. And that and the cracking and the gnawing is from the station itself.
So this was all made during what year?
Project started in 2019, and then we all know what happened in 2020. Yeah. So what was supposed to be multiple trips up to the museum and back became us working remotely and trying to figure out a way to produce this without ever being in the same room together.
So your process would have been, you're keeping track of people that you think would be a great fit for a future project. You reached out to them and shared pieces that you had processed a little bit, and then everybody started sending in their contribution. Yep. And you assembled it.
Yep.
And you did that. How many, you have this, you have how many tracks on here? You have,
it's 10.
So you did this 10 times.
Yeah. And it's organized, into four sections. And the first track we heard is part of chapter one, which I call Invocation.
Right.
We're trying to slightly mimic this Western religious tradition of you invoke a spirit to begin your worship service. And then as we move into part two of the record, and we can play one track off of part two, this is reverie. So you've invoked, you've gathered, you've assembled, and then a reverie for me, it's a daydream. It's a little bit psychedelic. It kind of blasts into some more fractured colors. So let's listen to one of the tracks from Reverie, which is where things get a little loopy. Was Station 5, and that's part of the Reverie section where where it seems like all the colors split into their individual hues and you're kind of lost in a daydream, literally a reverie, and it gets a little more thumping. So those, that four on the floor beat is really the, well, it's Brad Weber mixed with the seismic thumps.
Right.
And so I'll talk a little bit about how I gleaned this audio from seismic data. So at the height of this experiment, it's actually called the EarthScope experiment, which is a pretty cool name. Mm-hmm. It's run by the IRIS Consortium, which is another nerdy scientific acronym for seismologists working all over the world to map the subterranean landscape. So there's a mapping element to this work where you are essentially creating a 3D model of that which exists below our feet.
Right.
And you do that through sound. So they're mapping the earth with sound. And there has to be a huge grid of these stations to parse that data and then to model it. So when I was talking with the Anchorage Museum, I was like, well, how can I possibly record Alaska? It's so big. It's so overwhelming. Like, what would I do? Would I like, I joke in the book, there's a book that goes along with this about attaching microphones to my feet or submerging them in the glaciers. And all of that seemed fun, but like, was there actually a way to record the fundamental, you know, the breath, the bones, the cracking of the earth? And I discovered that there were these 280 seismometers all over Alaska, which I like to call my giant, beautiful recording studio.
Right.
So all the microphones were there, and it was just a matter of accessing the data, which is accessible to the public, online databases. So I figured out how to find that data, and then the challenge was turning it into sound. And so I worked with Dr. Debbie Kilb, who's a seismologist at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, who developed this custom script in MATLAB, which is the ubiquitous scientific computing software, to turn these movements into sound. And nice. So I figured that out. MATLAB is not my cup of tea.
Right.
Super, super technical. So we took those sounds and... maybe let's play an example from the third chapter of the album. First, we'll play some of those raw seismic sounds again, and then we'll hear how they turn into a track. So here are some, let's do station number 9, which is part of the Rhapsody chapter to the album. And this is, if you think about Rhapsody, you think about celebratory. It feels very spiritually victorious. Yeah. So Hannah's vocals are really exultant here. So first we'll hear a little seismic sounds, and then we'll hear how I translated them into a track, which is station 9.
Oh,
a book, I was imagining, because I tried to probably make it more literal, that there was a, that they drilled down into the earth and put a microphone in there. But what they're doing is they're drilling down, or they're reading. They don't even need to maybe drill into the earth to catch the seismic activity and to catch what's going on underneath the earth's surface.
They do drill into the earth.
Okay. So really it does go down in there.
It's a, it's about a 3 meter deep boring hole.
Okay.
And these are super remote locations. And I've been to the warehouse and saw all the equipment and met the scientists who do this. It's pretty adventurous.
Yeah.
So they'll take two helicopters out, and one helicopter, has a giant rope hanging from it and mm-hmm. is carrying this huge seismic monitoring station, which looks like a, it's about half the size of a Volkswagen. It's like an oversized refrigerator with solar panels and all this cool stuff on it. And then the other helicopter carries two seismologists.
Nice.
And they go out there with a huge boring auger, and they drill a 3 meter deep hole. And then inside of that goes a long cylinder, and then the seismometer drops down into that hole, which is kind of like a microphone.
Yeah.
And it records on three axes, like north, south, east, west, and up, down. So when the earth moves, right, this isn't just earthquakes. This could be waves, or just the slow moving of tectonic plates, could be magma, all these different types of things cause the earth to move. And these pick them up very accurately. And because they're 3 meters deep, they're not going to pick up necessarily like a squirrel falling off of a tree as
right.
much as they do what's underneath them. So all of those working in concert create this huge mesh of movement. And as I was explaining, create this map of what's underneath our feet.
Nice. And in it, when we get to the final section, which we're moving into now, it could also tell that the earth was quieter above, like jet traffic and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So this leads into what is the final chapter. And I didn't think there would be a final chapter. I thought this was three chapters to the book and to the album. Invocation, Reverie, and Rhapsody. And there were going to be nine tracks split across those three chapters. And that was going to be the project. And then, obviously, we know what happened in the spring of 2020.
Right.
And I was sitting in my driveway in June reading the New York Times, and this article in the science section talked about, during COVID lockdowns, the greatest seismic quieting
yeah.
ever measured.
Yeah.
And so all of us experienced in different ways in different parts of the world how our lives quieted, how the streets quieted, how the skies quieted. And that was quite a phenomenon for those of us who spend a lot of time listening and thinking about sound. It was both harrowing and beautiful mm-hmm. at the same time. But this was saying the earth itself became quiet because of reduced human activity. And then it referenced the actual scientific journal Science, where a huge, I think 200 seismologists from all over the world co-authored this paper showing quite distinctly in each city when lockdowns occurred, which of course first happened in China, then Taiwan, and then Hong Kong, and then Italy, which right. got hit hard early, then they locked down. There are seismometers in all of these cities. And so they went and tracked all of this information, and it really did become quiet. So right. I thought, this is compelling. Let's see if these remote stations in Alaska, even far away from people, quieted, and they did.
Yeah.
And so I thought, this is a story that has to at least be attempted to tell. So that's when I wrote to National Geographic. They loved the story and funded the last chapter. So the idea is to end this journey with a quieting. And I thought, who better to be the voice of this quieting than Laraji? And I've followed his work forever. I think it's Ambient Volume 3 back in 1980. It was produced by Brian Eno, is one of my Desert Island mm-hmm. albums that I returned to. And I'd also been playing a lot of auto harp on this album, which he does too, with auto mm-hmm. harps and zithers. So it just seemed like the perfect fit. So I wrote to Laraji, and he loved the idea. He does a lot of chanting and laughter workshops.
Uh-huh.
And so I sent him some basic chords and asked him to chant and hum. But he also ended up sending me a lot of laughter. Nice. And I thought, I don't know if this speaks to quieting the laughter, but maybe after the quieting is this emotional release.
Yeah.
And so the laughter was too good not to use. And so the final track is me on all of the instruments and Laraji humming and ultimately ending the track with some laughter. So this last track is Station 10, The Great Quieting.
Think about so just going back to the book and also to some of the things about that you were just saying about the quieting and attention, there's poetry in the book, and there in the writing that you have from folks that contributed is about, feels to me to be about paying attention in other ways too. So the whole idea of having this really be released as a book that has an album in a little card inserted into it, you're also doing it on vinyl?
Yes.
So there are artifact aspects to this, and the book is one of them. Within it, you're focusing on poetry and with some of the people who contribute. And it was interesting to me that the New York Times article and reading contributed to as an inspiration to what you're working on. How important is it for you to have writers and writing involved in this as another layer of work that's part of the whole collaboration?
I think almost every Fieldworks album, and this is the 10th in the series,
yeah,
has involved a writer in some capacity, mostly because my own voice is not enough. Mm-hmm. I am interested in seeing how other people think about the same things that I'm thinking about,
yeah,
and giving them a lot of lenient room to work through these ideas in the ways that they think about them. So this collection was an attempt to get some really different voices from different parts of the country and of the world who think about things differently than I do, and to see if we can put them in a volume that explores how we navigate through space, how we navigate ourselves in relationship to the planet, and how we ultimately listen to the things around us, and doing so in a more of an emotional way than of an analytical one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked with the folks at Printext, who I've collaborated with on several of these projects, and they did more of the curation of the writing, mm-hmm, and then they also designed the book.
Right.
So this is a real collaborative enterprise, this book.
Yeah, and the whole idea that it seems to share, which you've been doing with all these projects really, is that art doesn't happen in isolation. One genre or one kind of artist isn't working over here without collaborate. I mean, it happens, but your preference feels like to bring those things together.
Yeah, I like both aspects. I like the moments in a project where I have complete control,
yeah,
and I am by myself making decisions and taking responsibility for those creative decisions. But then I like doing the opposite and throwing the ball to a writer whose work I find really interesting that I may not even understand,
mm-hmm,
and seeing if that person can bring something meaningful to the project. So there's a constant give and take of having creative control and of relinquishing that control completely. The metaphor I've used for the Fieldworks collection is it's a sonic museum.
Right.
And each record is a new gallery that we build.
Mm-hmm.
And those galleries are filled with artwork. Each track is a piece of art. And sometimes I am the curator. Sometimes I'm the artist itself, but I'm also the museum's maintenance technician and fundraiser,
right,
and promotions development person. So yeah, I feel like I'm trying to build this invisible museum filled with these sonic wonders for listeners and audiences to experience.
And they're all linked together in different ways, it feels like, and moving in a... It's interesting to move underground when you've been... You know, do you feel like there's a direction that things are moving with these that are linked together? Or is it just, here's the thing that I'm finding interesting right now, I want to go and explore that?
I certainly am pursuing my own interests, but I'm also trying to peel the onion.
Mm-hmm.
And what's at the center? And so, yeah, it's literal, like I've gone beneath the surface of the earth, but it's also metaphorical for trying to get to a deeper truth.
Right.
And so like the first record I did 8 years ago was on Washington Street. And that was, in hindsight, very surface. I mean, mm-hmm, it's just people, it's mm-hmm, just people talking, people chattering, mm-hmm, cars, planes, railroad tracks, you know, barking seals at the zoo, that surface. And then, so maybe with each one, I've tried to go to a deeper level of the way someone drops into meditation.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't try not to overthink these things, but, since you're making me, I think I'm sinking deeper into a creative state.
Yeah. I think what you're also doing, you know, I like Eggleston photography. It was what I really love. But the main thing I love about it is it's capturing things that people would overlook. So with Washington Street, people are going up and down the National Road all the time. They don't ever even appreciate or think about any of the people out there. All of these things that you're exploring are things that would be overlooked or unheard, like in the case of the bats, like you can't even hear it. So it's you're bringing that to our attention.
Yeah, and I would argue that that's maybe the definition of what being an artist is. or perhaps the goal.
Right. Or a poet, and that, you know, and all kinds of artists.
Artists, yeah. In the widest sense, right. to help us see, hear, feel things that we normally wouldn't.
Yeah, and to take the time. And it feels like that's another big part of your process, is just investing time and attention to what you're interested in.
Yeah. And in my case, we live in such a visual world that's, you know, I'm just inundated with imagery. Listening as a second way of understanding not just ourselves, but the ecology of our planet, threatened ecosystems, and, you know, coming back to the, you know, being able to close your eyes and understand a story through the medium of sound and music,
right.
Is what the Fieldworks body of work is trying to do.
What are you working on next? Do you have ideas already, or are you taking a break, or what? Taking a break, I'm sure.
Well, I have tons of ideas. I think it's always, I know a lot of people can relate to this, but I'm only interested in the next project. And so it's right. Even hard to talk about stuff that is particularly a project that's gone on for like 2.5 years.
Right.
I am trying to learn as much as I can about bioelectricity, and that's super interesting to me.
Yeah.
It very much relates to the other types of things I've done in this work of like what makes sound that we can't hear.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a new direction I'm going in. Similar to our field of vision, which only sees in certain spectra. Our hearing is limited to a pretty tight range,
right.
And what's on either side of that. And so that's also kind of unveiling, pulling back the curtain to see what's on the other side. So yeah, bioelectricity.
Nice. So if people want to get a hold of this, how do they do that? How do they find the book and the record?
The book and the record are available on April 1st. It's been produced as a vinyl LP and a CD. Those are both available directly from the label Temporary Residence, or at your local record store, or through Bandcamp. The book is published by the Dutch publisher Japsam, and so it's available for order directly from their website. That's Japsam. The U.S. distributor would find that in bookstores, if those things exist anymore.
Right.
or just online bookshops.
And the easiest way to maybe get to all that is through your website?
Yes. Finally updated it with all this new stuff, and that's stuarthyatt.org.
Spell your name for us.
Stuarthyatt.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Stuart. It's always a pleasure to talk to you about these things, and I always enjoy following them in the process of you making them as you share what you're doing. So we'll look forward to seeing your bioelectricity. Is that what it is?
Yeah, we'll see. Thanks for having me, Jim, and awesome to be on WQRT.